morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with the author Mandivamba Rukuni about his new book called Being African. Right now, I would like to welcome Elizabeth Keller. She is the Education Programs Director at the Santa Fe Children's Museum, and Ollie Greer, who is Executive Chef at the Ore House, and he is a self-taught entomologist and the collector of an extraordinary bug collection that's on view at the Children's Museum starting next week, Wednesday. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Now, Elizabeth, I went yesterday and saw this bug collection, which we're going to be talking about it, and we call it a bug collection because it's not just insects, it's arachnids and insects. How did you find out about it?
Well, I first saw it when one of the Ore House crew had her daughters in my class, and so Ollie brought a few cases of these insects and spiders up to my classroom, and the kids flipped. They just loved it, and he could talk. They would sit for longer than they would ever sit to listen to him talk about all the bugs for about an hour and a half. And so I've known about
children,
him for a while.
ADD, little Game Boy people, and they're listening for an hour and a half straight.
Right.
Amazing.
Right. Well, he's a good storyteller, too. And then other times, eating at the restaurant, somehow I ended up down there, or my family and friends ended up down in his basement bug room. And so when Susan McIntosh, who is a local kindergarten teacher at Gonzales and also the founder of the Santa Fe Science Initiative, came to me and she'd heard about them and said, couldn't we get these at the museum? I knew immediately what she was talking about and said, absolutely, we have to have them here.
And so these are going to be at the museum for some time, and there's a lot of events which we'll talk about in a little while. Why do kids love bugs?
Well,
and grown-ups not? Some kids don't like bugs either. We'll talk about that.
Do you want to take this or do you want me?
No, well, Elizabeth first and then you.
Well, I think kids like anything that's extreme, and so bugs being small, intricate, so different looking, colorful, kind of extreme, like a dinosaur on the other end being gigantic, simpler maybe. But there's just something about them that sparks their imagination with their parts and their colors and again, the size and the is important to me. I think kids like things that are really little, and it's part of their world, where it's not really part of ours.
What about you, Ollie Greer? Why do you think kids like bugs?
Because they're just interesting to look at. Their legs, their antennas, their wings, the way they move. Some kids are into them. Some are terrified. I was arachnophobic since I was born, and I still am, but that compels me to collect them.
So you are scared of bugs, always have been, and so you have a bug collection.
Well, specifically spiders. Butterflies and beetles don't faze me, but spiders make me just cold sweating, dog puking, nauseous. I mean, still in the shower, a tiny spider the size of my fingernail gives me the closest thing to a heart attack.
What about snakes?
Oh, I love snakes. Lizards, reptiles,
so it's just
heavily
arachnids.
Into that as a kid.
Very interesting. So how did you start collecting? I mean, did you, as a 10-year-old, say to yourself, I'm scared of bugs, therefore I'm going to start collecting them?
No. My mom and dad had a really beautifully illustrated insect encyclopedia in our library at home. And when I was 10 and living in Tiburon, California, I happened to find a large dead wasp in our backyard. And I managed to look it up and identify it in this bug book. So making the connection between the real thing in my hand and the picture and information about it in the book was just really interesting and stimulating to my young imagination. And I read the rest of the book, which contained pictures of all kinds of giant monstrosities from around the world. Moths, butterflies, beetles, spiders, scorpions. And I was just riveted, and I promised myself someday I would complete that book, and I have.
At a certain point in your, early teenage years, you apprenticed yourself to a professor of entomology.
Mm-hmm. His name's David Kistner. He was the professor of entomology at Cal State Chico in Chico, California, which is about 150 miles north of San Francisco. And he needed a lab assistant. We met through a mutual family friend. And he put me to work. So every day after school for 3 years, I was his lab assistant and apprentice, and I learned how to set and pin and arrange these insects. And I did a small display for the science building, which he told me is still there. So I did it as a volunteer. He never paid me money, but he did pay me with an incredibly rare beetle called Zeuthrus harris, which is now extinct and one of the rarest specimens in the entire world.
And that's going to be at the Children's Museum
as
well.
Yes, it will.
Now, that's it. I saw this insect yesterday, and I'm not particularly scared of bugs, spiders, or much of anything else along those lines, but this was a scary friggin' bug.
It's enormous, and I have a medium-sized specimen. It is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as one of the two largest beetles in the world, and they're now extinct because the natives in Fiji ate it out of existence. The 12-inch larva are a delicacy, and the adult beetle is very strong. It can cut your finger clean off your hand with its jaws.
12-inch larva.
Mm-hmm.
That's very big.
Yeah, that's just the nature of their life cycle.
But that's bigger than the insect itself.
Yes. That is typical of most beetles and butterflies and moths, actually. The Atlas moth and birdwing butterfly caterpillars are the size of hot dogs. But the adult butterfly weighs far less and has a much smaller body, and the mass of the wings is measured in micrograms. They're paper thin. So that's just part of the miracle of Mother Nature's adaptability and the life cycles of these things.
It's also really great to see the local insects here in the collection, and I know that some of them were collected by some of the children that Ollie knows, and they've brought him insects, and then he'll show them how he mounts them and get them involved, and so they get really excited to see their wolf spider or their moth on display along with these other exotic insects, which is really wonderful.
Well, the whole bug presentation at schools program began with my coworkers and their kids hanging out in my office at work and seeing my bugs and asking me, you know, in second and third grade, would you do show and tell? Would you do show and tell at my school? So that's how it started, and it just blossomed into something really huge. And one really sweet little anecdote, Daniela Carr, the former general manager of the Orr House, lived out in El Dorado, and she had two daughters, Kaylee and Michaela. And I was assistant chef at this time, it was about 7 years ago, and I got a call while I was cooking, and I went to answer it, and I always say, this is Ollie, and it was her four-year-old daughter, Kaylee, and Kaylee went, Ollie,
we found
a spider. And they did. They found an enormous wolf spider, about 3.5 inches across, in their house. They thought it was a tarantula. And Daniela said at first they panicked, but then they made the connection that this is a spider, and Ollie collects spiders, and
right,
they needed to catch it and give it to me. So they did. And it was just a really sweet moment. So I went back to Desert Montessori and brought the frozen, limp, dead spider and showed them how I set this whole thing. I got the fangs out, the pedipalps, all 8 legs, straighten out the body, and that was a really rewarding moment. So they all made the connection between how a real thing looks when it's alive, then it's dead, and then it goes in my collection with a lot of tender care and painstaking work.
Now, there's a lot of not just spiders, but insects that you've found that were, you know, roadkill.
Mm-hmm.
They're in very good condition. Others are killed. Others are collected. How do you negotiate the whole issue of endangered insect species and arachnid species, making sure that you don't contribute to their extinction?
Well, there's an institution called CITES, C-I-T-E-S, the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species, and they have issued a list over the past few decades on insects that are considered threatened and endangered because of various environmental, natural, or man-made causes. And there are certain insects on that list, like Ornithoptera alexandria, the world's largest butterfly. There's a couple of Papilio swallowtails out of the Caribbean. There's a couple of various beetles. And the Xerxes butterfly from Northern California is now extinct because of all the residential development in that area. So CITES exists to protect these species, so they issue lists of protected species to the various dealers and exporters around the world that these are not allowed out of those countries. I have a couple of very rare specimens that used to be endangered, but because of collectors like me who are willing to shell out obscene amounts of money for certain kinds of unusual insects, these butterfly purveyors in Papua New Guinea, for example, have been able to buy protected government land and establish a private protected butterfly ranch to repopulate these endangered species. So I now have three different species of that. One in particular is the eggs are susceptible to a kind of parasitic fly. So the minute the eggs are laid, they're devoured. And this protected environment has enabled these butterflies to now flourish, and six pairs a year are allowed out of the country, out of Papua New Guinea, for collectors and for research. I have one of those pairs from 2005, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous butterfly, very unusual compared to the others of its kind. And it's important for collectors to keep collecting these things because that enables, the cash flow enables these poor natives and villagers to maintain this business. Otherwise, some of them will go extinct.
We're talking to Ollie Greer and Elizabeth Keller about the insect exhibition, or the bug exhibition, which is about to open on September 3rd of next week at the Santa Fe Children's Museum. It's interesting how you, Ollie, mount the insects. It's really some combination between entomology and art.
Mm-hmm. Well, that just grew out of a desire to do something really different. I've researched hundreds of private and public museum collections, and they all look the same. There's nothing that distinguishes them. And I have about four dozen entomology books, specific butterfly and moth books, and other general ones that encompass everything. And there's a kind of setting called academic mounting, where the legs and antenna are just kind of huddled up against the body. The wings are spread out, swept forward, which is not a natural pose. And since I was a kid, I've been fascinated by giant bugs, and I've always had to know how long the body is, how long the legs are, the antennas, the wingspans, but accurately. And I figured out configurations on my own of how to do the legs, the antennas, and the wings to get an accurate measurement. And I just have to know. Plus, it helps put in perspective where my own collection stands as far as other collections in the world and their giant specimens. And I have researched every giant, biggest specimen of every kind of insect ever caught, and what I have doesn't even come close. And I have some enormous bugs.
But the way they're displayed is not just the way you spread them out. I mean, the color choice, the arrangement, yeah, in the case. People who work at the museum who are not at all inclined towards insects are fascinated by just the look. They're so beautiful. I mean, just stunningly beautiful arrangement. The spider legs, the way they go together, the insects in the case, the color choice, they're just beautifully arranged.
And the insects themselves, they remind you of silk, mm-hmm, of jewels, of watercolors, of textiles, of handmade paper. I mean, they are of stained glass, of, you know, I mean, they are art, you know, in themselves, even though they're products of nature.
That's where those patterns in cloth and paper and textures and jewels have
come from
in all these different cultures around the world. They base their art and textiles on what's around them in nature. And the way I displayed them, I just started in the center top of each case and worked my way down and around. And basically, the insects themselves kind of told me where to go based on the initial configuration of the legs and wings and antenna of each individual specimen. I suddenly had, like, they interlocked together like a puzzle. And it was a matter of finding which one fit where. It's all trial and error, and it took hundreds and hundreds of hours just to arrive at these final display cases, not to mention the thousands of hours it took to set each individual one. But the colors, the spacing, the arrangement of each display case was part my technique and spiritually kind of the bugs themselves telling me where I needed to put them.
We have art projects every afternoon at the museum that are part of museum admission, and so around this exhibit I've planned all kinds of insect art programs, from mask making and things to I think there's bug rock pets and iridescent insects and bug shrines and all kinds of things. But mostly I think the kids are going to come in, and whether I'd planned it or not, after seeing these things, they will draw, paint, create, build insects and bugs. And it's just really inspiring. I was talking to one of the artists there today, and he went over and looked at the couple cases that we have up right now of insects, and he said, oh, I can't wait to see what the children start painting. He said, I know, they're just going to immediately start painting bugs, and we should put their artwork up, too. And so.
And some of them are so beautiful. For example, you have many, many moths and butterflies that are exquisite. And where the males and females are different, you have them both. And you, the person who didn't know that they were the same species wouldn't think they were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did that for my own, just to satisfy the need to put them, to display them in a way that I could tell them apart. I mean, you can tell them apart individually, but I wanted to have the males and the females in vertical columns, so that they would all just aesthetically match. The point about the kids drawing and being inspired is, well, it just ties in perfectly with the 33 shows I did for the Santa Fe schools from 1998 to 2004 before I got my first big promotion at the Ore House and had no more time to do that. I have about 1,000 letters, notes, cards, and pictures from those schools. The kids all started drawing pictures on their own, and the teachers saved all of them and put together these posters with thank yous on them, and I have a huge thick stack of them in a box, and I just have no space in my office to post them now. But if my other plans materialize in the future and I have actual office space, I want to post every one of those on the walls, because they're very touching, they're very sweet, and I was so pleased to do something for the kids that stimulated their imaginations and took their attention away from their cell phones and texting and their iPods and their computer games, because those things do nothing for kids. They're just, they're digital drugs, and I'm deeply upset by this trend. The companies that create those things don't care about what happens to the kids. They just want the parents' money.
Good point, ladies and gentlemen. Bugs, not drugs.
Yeah.
So is there any relationship between your work as a collector of insects and your work as a chef? You've been a chef for a couple of decades.
22 years now at the Ore House. The connection is that I'm a perfectionist in everything that I do. And when I was still assistant chef and cooking upstairs for 16 years and plating hundreds of dishes each night, everything had to look just perfect, and my standard was it all had to look good enough to be photographed. So I kind of applied that to everything. So each dish was as organized and detailed as the bug collection was. So,
do you have a favorite insect or a couple of them?
Yeah. The Zeuxanthus harrow's beetle that Dr. Kistner paid me with for the 3 years of work as his assistant from 1979 to 1981, that is the crown jewel of the collection. There are, the last I researched from a Japanese paper by four entomologists on Zeuxanthus beetles, they listed every museum they went to and every specimen of Zeuxanthus harrow's that they examined, and there are less than 20 specimens in the entire world in museum collections, and there are probably twice that many in private collections. Mine is one of them, so it's not just my own favorite, most significant specimen in my collection. I mean, I put 3 years of my life working for it, so when I die, it gets buried with me. It was a really significant achievement for me to be rewarded with that beetle. It's one of the rarest in the entire world, and it's just a spectacular form of life. There's just no other beetle like it. It has all the features of an interesting beetle: big mandibles, big body, big antenna, big legs, all in one.
How do you keep the insects from decaying? I mean, they are organic matter.
Well, when they're alive, moisture is what they need to survive. But when they are dead and mounted in displays, moisture is their worst enemy. As long as they're kept airtight and dry in a specially made box, they will last for centuries. The Smithsonian Institution and the British Museum of Natural History have hundreds of thousands, actually that's tens of millions, of specimens collected during the 1718 and early 1900s, during those great ages of exploration. And they've been meticulously preserved, bone dry and airtight, and they're still around. I have seen many photographs of old, old specimens, and they look as good today as they did back then. So,
how do you dry them? I mean, you don't put them in the oven.
Oh, no, you just let them sit and just...
In a desert climate?
Well, this desert climate, Santa Fe, is just perfect for this kind of thing. Perfect. I mean, when I find dead butterflies on my street, Bishop's Lodge Road, that have been bounced off of cars and died, after a day or so, they're completely dry already. So just let it dry naturally. Spiders take a lot longer because they're full of fluid and goop, and they smell like dead wet dogs when they're drying. It's really, you can imagine the 46 tarantulas in my collection, I had to do that.
I have to say, one of my early memories of first living in Santa Fe when I first moved here in the 90s was I was down at the community college and there weren't very many people around, and I was just walking down the sidewalk and in front of me was this tarantula sharing the sidewalk going ka-thump, 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 and I thought, I'm not on the East Coast anymore, ladies and gentlemen.
I would not have survived that encounter. I'm absolutely serious.
I just thought it was just an amazing moment of here we all are together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping nobody would kill it.
Well, tarantulas do have long lifespans, so if it didn't get run over by a car, it probably managed to get across and have
still
a
here.
Long, healthy life. Yeah, very possible.
How long do tarantulas live?
Between 10 to 20 years, depending on the species.
That could still be here. The another thing that I wanted to mention that really struck me, I mean, probably many of our listeners or some of our listeners know that arachnids are much closer evolutionarily to like lobsters than they are to insects. But you've got some actual arachnids that look more like lobsters than they do like spiders.
Well, I have, besides spiders and tarantulas, I have scorpions, vinegaroons or whip scorpions, whip spiders, and camel spiders, which there's a lot of false information about, but they're all part of that group of arthropods, multi-segmented bodies. Insects are categorized by having a head, a thorax, an abdomen, three body sections, four wings, two antenna, two eyes, six legs. But spiders and other arthropods are still considered insects because insect is derived from the Latin insectare,
insectors. Yeah.
So spiders and those other arthropods, even lobsters and crayfish, sand crabs, they all have an exoskeleton with soft innards. So they're all related, from a flea to a whip spider to a beetle to a butterfly to a shrimp to a lobster. They are all related.
Elizabeth Keller, what are some of the activities going on besides the art and drawing?
Well, we'll have, for preschool students, we'll have acting out, say, the life cycle of a butterfly, or playing Ant Follow the Leader, and some creative dramatics around the insect exhibit. Also, it's really unusual for the Children's Museum to have any exhibit that's not interactive, so we'll make this as interactive as we can, and we'll provide containers for kids to go out and do their own insect hunting on the grounds and bring the insects in and be able to look at them with magnifying glasses and dead specimens under microscopes and insect body parts under microscopes. And we'll also have some open-ended scavenger hunts that you can go through.
That includes scavenging insects?
Scavenging insects and things from the collection. So, you know, find one that looks like this and find some other that are the color of that or the size of this. So once I have the collection in there, I'll be able to make up some great scavenger hunts. Those are our main activities at the museum around this.
Elizabeth Keller is the Education Programs Director at the Santa Fe Children's Museum. Ollie Greer is Executive Chef at the Ore House. He is a amateur, self-taught amateur in the sense of love, doing it from love. Entomologist, an insect collector, bug collector, and his extraordinary bug collection will be shown at the Santa Fe Children's Museum starting on Wednesday, September 3rd, and going
through Halloween.
Through Halloween. That's a good time to
end. We wanted to have it. Definitely we wanted to have it there on Halloween.
Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Mandivamba Rukuni. He is the author of the book Being African, Rediscovering the Traditional Unhu Ubuntu Boto Pathways of Being Human. And he is also the Regional Director for African Programs with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation in Pretoria. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary.
It's wonderful to have you here, and it's a very interesting book. First of all, let's start with the words in the title that probably most of our listeners don't know. Unhu Ubuntu Poto, pathways. What do those words mean?
Unhu meaning actually being human, because the African idea of the difference between other animals and us is that we have a higher level of consciousness. So Unhu is really a human being, or being human. and that's Ubuntu.
So the book is really a call to African people, African American people, to follow a spiritual path, which is also very much of a practical path that's based in African tradition, African spirituality. Right. What led you, yourself, Western educated Christian, to start following this path and writing about it?
Well, because I'd been exposed to it as a young person to start with, before I started going to school, and then learning to speak English and learning about all the worldly knowledge in English. But as I got older and I became a professional, I began to realize that what human society is about, we probably have forgotten, and it's probably still somewhere forgotten back in the traditional values that I experienced as a young person in my family and community.
So that's saying quite a lot, that the world has forgotten what human society is all about.
I think we are lost.
What, in what way are we lost, and what do you think human society is about that we need to refine?
I mean, I just have to start with the most advanced society in the whole world, the United States of America.
Advanced in some ways.
In some ways, but it's, you can look at how technologically advanced we have become over the last 100 years. You would think that with all this technology, which spans from biological technologies, are able to cure diseases, grow crops, to physical ones, you know, we're able to fly fast around the world, even send people to the moon. But we have no clue how to construct a violence-free society. We have lost capacity to actually craft viable, sustainable families where young people grow up in safe, loving, a respectful environment. So, in spite of all these advances, we've forgotten what is truly the human values.
Now, did you grow up in a safe, loving, functional society and family?
Absolutely. In fact, I was telling a group of young American youngsters in May this year when I visited, and they were, to me, they looked pretty much like very angry, disinterested youngsters in life. They're just disappointed, and I was saying to them, you know, look at me, I'm from Africa. I grew up with no shoes until I was about 11, and no electricity, no radio, no television to entertain me, no refrigerator to pull out juice. And I said to them, and we even had real witches in our village, you know, not imaginary ones you see on television. So raise up your hand if you feel sorry for me. And they all raised up their hand. And I said to them, I'm really sorry to disappoint you, because even in my material poverty as a youngster, I was infinitely happier than I see you today. Because I grew up, I was brought up in a loving, caring, respectful family. I grew up knowing who I was and happy with who I was. I did not want to be anybody else. I didn't want to be the son of the rich man next door. So I'm capable of being happy irrespective of my material well-being. This is what the world has lost, and that's why we've drifted into individualism, consumerism, greed, and violence, drugs. And I don't believe that we even know now how to stop the environmental degradation, the high level of consumption, of limited and you know, resources that we have, which will plunge us in less than 100 years backwards as in terms of civilization.
So in a way, you don't know how to stop it. Nobody knows how to stop it. We all feel like we're heading for the edge of a cliff. But on the other hand, you've written this book, which is really a call for a renaissance of life practices and values.
I have, because I still see, well, when I look at Africa, 70% of our people are still rural. Okay, they are poor. But the idea of a big city, or the big city-state, is failing in Africa. In fact, it has failed. You just have to go to any of the big cities, Johannesburg, Harare, Lagos. It's total chaos. So in many ways, we are lucky that this model has failed in Africa, because if it had succeeded, then it would be a lot more difficult to reverse this trend of creating huge urban industrial complexes, which really are breeding ground for morons, where you have 90% plus of your populations living in, and that society becomes more difficult to redress. But I think in Africa, we have a lot of scope for redressing this, and a lot of scope for having a society which is less destructive of the environment, less violent, and more capable of having smaller communities that are self-sustaining and not reliant too much on heavy-duty state sponsored infrastructure.
One of the things that is a problem on the whole planet, whether it be the United States or various countries in Africa or Europe or wherever, is the question of the relationship between population numbers and the ability of the land to sustain us. So we've overfished the seas, and yes, we have really over-cultivated the land and cultivated it badly. How do you take that into account? I know this is one of your areas of expertise, when you talk about going to from an urban to a more village-based system.
Well, if we just start with the most limiting factor in terms of the rate at which we sustain the 6-7 billion people on the planet, it's fossil fuels. I mean, and the reserves in the ground today are not going to last more than another 30 to 50 years. So it doesn't matter how we look at it. In 50 years' time, we won't have the oil, the coal, and the natural grass to sustain 6 billion, or at that time it would be 10 billion people. So when these natural resources run out, the energy reserves that remain on Earth in terms of trees and so on that we can harvest immediately can only sustain maybe less than a billion people. So what's going to happen to the 5-10 billion? So already we are on a path where we have to reduce the extent to which we have an agricultural system so dependent on fossil fuels to cultivate as well as to fertilize the land. It's just not sustainable. We have to go back to find other ways of producing sufficient food locally that is consumed locally, rather than the United States producing most of the food to feed the developing world thousands of miles away, which is the current situation.
When you look at Africa is a vast continent, and when you look at the arable land there and the numbers of people there, let's say there were no fossil fuels, everybody was cultivating the land by hand and fertilizing with natural materials and dung and plowed by oxen and all of that stuff. Do you have the ability to feed an increasing population in Africa, self-sustaining?
Well, you see, the issue we're faced with is that the population in Africa at the moment will not be sustained by an organic farming within the next few years. We are already too many. But we are too many because the population growth was spared by this availability of fossil fuels worldwide. So although going back is not the solution, the point is continuing on the path that we have now, which will end up with 10, 12 billion people on this planet in another 30 to 50 years, is worse. So we need a middle ground where we start reversing this whilst finding alternative ways of using energy more sustainably. And unfortunately, we just have to have fewer people on this planet.
We're talking to Mandivamba Rukuni, whose book is called Being African. And he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books, by the way, tomorrow, Friday, August 29th at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You mentioned in the book the relationship between African culture and Western culture, and you say, let's modernize but not westernize, and you talk about ways in which other cultures, Asian and European and so on, have modernized. But what's the distinction between modernizing and westernizing?
Well, the distinction is, if you know, ancient cultural wisdom is the wisdom that has existed over long periods of time. But over time, some of that gets outdated, or a situation changes so that it becomes less relevant. Modernizing means you adapt your culture to meet the contemporary situation.
An example
is the shirt I'm putting on now. This is an African shirt. Okay, you cannot mistake it for a Western shirt.
Right.
But this is not what my ancestors used to put on, is it? No. I have modernized an African way of looking at dress. This is modernization, not Westernization.
Interesting.
So, same thing, you could come and look at my home in Africa. You find that it's pretty comfortable home. But the architecture is not Western. It's an African architecture. That's modernization. Westernization means wholesale, you believe that you stop being African. You learn a foreign language. You speak their language. You take their religion. You take their educational system. You take their monetary system. You just take wholesale everything they have. The problem with that, of course, is that you can never be an American. You can never perfect that culture because you don't know where it started and where it's going.
So you as an African can never be an American. Yeah.
No, I can never beat an American at being an American.
Right.
And the Americans can never beat me at being an African. So I'm better off improving what I have and then borrowing intelligently. I can borrow from American culture, but incorporate it in my culture, Africanize it.
You talk about reviving African culture and languages and how important it is to have people speak and know their languages. There's so many languages. So how do you work the dialectic between, on the one hand, having unity and on the other hand, speaking many disparate languages?
Well, it's simple. I mean, it should be simple. We've made it complicated. The thing is, it is possible to use a mother tongue for education, for educating.
What's your mother tongue?
My mother tongue is Shona, which is one of maybe five languages in my country, but mine is spoken by about 80%, because it's a small country, so it's possible
Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe. So it's possible to have a majority of people speak one language. But the point is that educating people in mother tongue makes it easier for people to relate education to their day-to-day lives.
Now, were you educated in your native language?
I was educated in English.
In English.
And that's why I explain in this book that in spite of my high level of education, I still have not been able to be effective in transforming the lives of the majority of people in my own extended family or tribe.
You don't speak fluent Shona?
I speak fluent Shona, but knowledge is not transferable like that. This is the whole point.
Right.
Knowledge is not, because knowledge is bound by culture. Translating it back into a cultural setting requires interpretation and reinterpretation of the same knowledge you think you have. That's why we have the third world today, where you'd think that with the amount of language and technology available in the world, you wouldn't have such poor countries, would you? But why aren't they changing in spite of all this available English language and available technology? It's because they don't easily translate when you get to the village level. What you think is knowledge that's applicable, you'll find that within that cultural setting is not acceptable, it doesn't quite fit. So you're better off educating people in their own mother language, so that they can immediately interpret the cultural meaning. I mean, take this little book I wrote on being African. I failed to write this book in English. It took me 10 years to write this book in English. And I didn't know that was the reason why I couldn't write it. Then 3 years ago, I taught a whole course. For 10 days, I took 45 youth into the mountains in the boot camp about being African, and taught it in my mother tongue. Within a month of doing that, I was able to rewrite the whole book in my head and then translated it back to English.
And then translated it back to English.
Because cultural knowledge is bound in language. Just an hour ago, I was talking to some Native Americans at a school,
Indian school?
Yeah, Santa Fe Indian school. And I find similarities. very striking similarities. Those Native Americans who stopped speaking their native language and use English as a mother tongue are able to educate their kids in English, and there's no, what is lost in their culture is lost. So they become American. The only problem is down the road they wish that their kids would speak the language and reinvent the language. So it's a different problem to where in some of the pueblos the kids are brought up in their traditional language. And then when they go to school they have to learn English. And then there is a clash. Because then what's more important? I was given an example of, say, a child who would be required to attend a traditional ceremony or ritual at home, but at school they are required to attend class. And if they want to have a 100% attendance record, where do you go? Which is more important? Okay, so these conflicts are everywhere, but I find nations who have transcended them better than others are ones who take knowledge from English-speaking world and translate it into their own language,
right,
like the Japanese did and the Chinese. Teach their kids in English and in university in their own language, and then learn English as a foreign language.
Now, when you talk about being African, Africa is a very big place with many different cultures, and one could argue many different cultural values. Are you saying that there is something that is transcendently African that unifies everybody on the continent?
In fact, I can go as far as saying that in spite of gazillion differences between different tribes of the whole world, I could pretty well write a book about the few values that are held by all human beings. So the same applies to Africa. In spite of the vast differences in culture and language, there are elements, and I put 10 of them in this little book.
Right, and which are very human elements, like laugh, play, and have fun, talk and listen with others,
yes,
give generously, receive with gratitude, and so on. Those are not just African, obviously. They're transcendent.
They're transcendent. So to be truly African is to be a true human being.
What does it mean, though, to be truly African in distinction to other cultures? What does it mean to be specifically African?
Well, I find that it's the way that our ancestors weaved into the cultural vessel elements of language and religion and education. Because you find that within the broader cultural setting, one of the most important things is believing in your ancestors, following the footsteps of your forebearers. Strong belief, not only that they're your connection to God, but also that they held wisdom tested over years available to you free of charge, that you had to rely on before you were too clever to start new ideas. I find that cutting across almost all of Africa. Then that same belief of value transcends then into understanding of oneness. Oneness between family members, oneness between relatives, and probably just as important, relationship between people and the environment. The environment is always bigger than people. We are part of the environment. We are not superior to the environment. That's a strong value I find in African culture, which I don't find in American culture, for instance, or European culture, where I see a lot of belief that science and knowledge makes people above the environment. You can destroy the environment and reconstruct it, or you can do whatever. When in traditional African beliefs, you are below. You are just part of it. So you are connected to the trees, the animals. You are connected to them just in as much as you're connected to God and your relatives. So you're
and many of the myths and stories that you talk about in the book reflect that.
Reflect, yeah. So I'm just telling you two of the important values which mean a lot in terms of how that translates to practical realities in life. Because as a youngster believing in that, it was almost impossible for me to go and chop down trees randomly.
Right.
It was not possible. The belief was you don't do that. you're killing yourself, you're killing your ancestors, and you're killing God. Now, with the knowledge that I have about science and what I can do and regenerate and GMOs, blah, blah, well, does it matter if I chop down half the forest? No, we'll find a way of reforesting or some other solution. So the value system has gone out of the window, and I've adopted a completely different value system.
One of the things that you also talk about as being very important is the African family structure, which is family, extended family, and so on, and how important it is to recognize that your father's brother is also your father and your mother's sister is also your mother. And and I wonder, you know, what will happen and how do you think about this in a world where population really has to reduce if we're going to sustain ourselves and people won't have so many brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins if we are going to voluntarily reduce our population?
Well, if you go back to the time when the extended family was of real value, it was less than 1 billion people on the planet. So actually it's not so much an aggregate number game. It's much more to do with how if you want unity and reliance on each other is perceived within a cultural setting, and
whether it be actual blood family or otherwise.
Oh yes, absolutely. And as you will notice, I cover in the book. Once you have friends, neighbors in the community, ultimately the bonds can be just as strong as relatives, and they may play a different role in your life. But the oneness between humans and humans and the environment is not present within African culture.
Now, this is a book, obviously, not just for Africans, African-Americans, the African diaspora, but really for everybody. Here you are in Santa Fe, which is about the most un-African city you can find.
You can say that again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, although I wrote the book for Africans, and the reason I insisted, and I still insist, is primarily for Africans, is because it is important for Africans to believe again that their self-identity and their culture will not only hold some wisdom for us recreating a dynamic society, but also if Africa is going to fulfill its destiny of also contributing to the world, whatever value, wisdom we have, this is it. So in that sense, this little message that I have is a message to the world, and that maybe it's time that the rest of the world, which may be advanced over Africa in many other respects, particularly wealth and material, but if we're going to look at this world 30 to 50 years from now, it may just be that Africa does have an important answer to the puzzle of what happens when we have overrun all the resources we have in the world.
Mandivamba Rukuni is the author of the book Being African, Rediscovering the Traditional Unu Ubuntu Boto Pathways of Being Human. He is the regional director for African programs with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation in Pretoria, and he will be at Garcia Street Books tomorrow, Friday, the 29th of August at 5 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Al Cohn. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista. Ciao.